I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This week on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to the second half of an interview with Dan Danello, the author of Technophobia, about the images of technology and the attitudes towards technology expressed in science fiction film. And then we'll be listening to a talk by Bradley Lewis, who spoke on December 1st at a forum organized by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and the International Humanist and Ethical Union at the United Nations on the topic of cognitive liberty and neurotechnology. So stay tuned for that.
Technophobia is really fueled by weapons technology to some extent and to a large extent. And so that's why I believe that sort of this vision of utopianism was undercut by the world wars and that use of technology, nuclear potential of nuclear war.
Well, also the environmental movement and the anti-nuclear power movement and postmodernism in the academe, and I think there's a lot of trends that have contributed to an anti-technology turn on the part of progressive thinkers. Let me ask you about your last, your penultimate chapter, actually, about technology is a virus. I just taught infectious disease policy this semester.
Yeah.
And I've always been, had an apocalyptic turn of mind as well as a utopian. I think the two are the turns of the same coin. But when teaching this class about technology and infectious disease, I was fascinated with these images of infectious technology or viral technology that you pulled together. Can you just give us a couple examples of where you see this viral technology and then what you think that they portend, what they are reflecting about popular thought?
I actually wrote a version of this chapter 5 years before I actually wrote the book, and so it existed in the background. I think I first was writing about viral horror and how that had become almost a substitute now for the sort of nuclear horror of the 50s and how a lot of popular culture dealt with that. And so I'm looking at the origins of those fears and, such as AIDS and the discoveries of new viruses, SARS and such as that. But I also then realized, to some extent, that the viral anxiety can be thought of as a metaphor for technophobia, and that technology, using Langdon Winner's autonomous technology as a sort of touchstone, the idea that technology is a kind of autonomous force, certainly not conscious at this point, but a kind of autonomous force that incorporates human beings into its own, to serve its own survival, growth, expansion, and ultimately, destroying humans in the process. And it was also fascinating to me the connection, say, between organic viruses and what they do and the notion of electronic viruses. And there seemed to be this this connection then between the organic and the electronic that I thought was fascinating.
But it also connects to Bill Joy's classic essay, The Future Doesn't Need Us, where he thinks that the key thing that makes nano, bio, and info technologies more dangerous for us in the future is that they can be potentially self-reproducing.
Exactly, and that actually goes way back to Frankenstein and the book where, the original book, not the movies that don't incorporate that, but the idea where Dr. Frankenstein initially is forced by the monster to create a female version, and then he realizes, I'm going to have a bunch of little Frankensteins running around the countryside, and he destroys and that really pisses off the monster, but this notion of technological self-replication is a frightening aspect, and some say that the whole, vision of nanotechnology really depends on technological self-replication as a basis, at least for its, for the all-encompassing aspects of nanotechnology.
To bring it all back around to where I started, I know that you're a film critic and you're pointing out things about, you know, the evolution of society and culture with this book that you think are reflected in science fiction. And you're not necessarily trying to, you know, write an advisory white paper for the EPA on how to regulate nanotechnology.
Right.
But, you know, when Michael Crichton writes this nonsense book that he wrote about Swarm, I think it was called.
Prey.
About, you know, nanites getting loose and trying to eat the population, et cetera, kind of gray goo scenario. We see that on the techno-progressive or transhumanist side. Mm-hmm. We see that as just getting in the way of having a serious discussion about nanopollution or eventually what to do to prevent gray goo scenarios.
Because it just presents this sort of what you would consider ridiculous negative consequence and doesn't really suggest any sort of safety measures or...
Exactly. It doesn't suggest that anybody's actually thought about these questions, tried to build a prophylactic regime to put in place. I mean, just as if you had said, you know, the existence of computer viruses, you know, if somebody had put a novel together about, oh, my God, in the future, we're going to be getting 5,000 spam a day and we're going to have these computer viruses eating everything and everything's going to crash. Mm-hmm. And then someone had concluded, oh, well, maybe this idea of personal computers and the Internet's not such a great idea.
Right. You're seeing it as a kind of... you know, blocking, it's almost like it's not really engaging in any sort of debate. It's sort of trying to close off debate by presenting this horrific sort of consequence without any alternative.
Right.
I'm entertained by Prey, but I can see that your point of view is that. I mean, and again, you're right, I don't offer many prescriptions, and I am writing about popular culture as opposed to, and although, you know, I'm trying to write about science for the person that's interested in popular culture. And I would love people that are interested in science fiction to know more about science. I think that's important. So, and to that extent, I feel like just by doing that, my book is a bit more expansive, and it does, you know, it certainly doesn't close off alternative points of view. I think I even, you know, in a latter part of it, I found your organization and, you know, the sort of more liberal democratic transhumanist, which is a real, to me, was a real improvement over, say, the Extropian version, which I guess they just shut down shop as far as, like, you know, their website went down. But I feel like people that, you know, should sort of research science and look into science, and I feel like I'm providing a little bit of that. And certainly I'm interested in, you know, technology that isn't just focused on, say, the human body, but it has more to do with social reform and has to do with helping, you know, enlarging social justice rather than, say, limiting it, or technology that can help us become more free rather than allowing us to be repressed. So exactly how to do that, I guess I don't feel, it's not my job, sir, but...
But I'm absolutely there with you. Okay. It's actually part of the mission of my little think tank, the IET, is to try to figure out how to engage with culture makers and culture critics like yourself to have this discussion about how can we identify the different kinds of biopolitical tropes that are in popular culture, and then say, you know, let's make a complex vision when we do our speculative fiction that, you know, doesn't just damn or praise technology,
right,
but actually creates a liberatory vision of what needs to happen. You know,
right,
to happen.
I agree. I mean, there should be some sort of model of the debate in the work rather than just sort of a closed-minded, you know, positive or negative spin on it, and I think that would help the debate. I'm not sure I was totally successful, but I do think I've tried to present some alternatives, and certainly I'm encouraging people not to be anti-science. I don't think that would not be a good thing. You know, I think our future is dependent on scientific and technological development.
Again, to direct everyone to Dan's website, it's shockproductions.com?
Correct. One word, Shock Productions.
Shockproductions.com, and he's got links there to things about the book, Technophobia, things about his films, a zine that he puts out, Shock Zine. What's Shock Life?
That's just about me.
that's just about Dan. And
the blog is sort of my political take on things.
Excellent. Well, Dan is a professor of film and video at Columbia College Chicago and has written this great book, Technophobia, Science Fiction Visions of Post-Human Technology, and I highly recommend it for the transhumanists and techno-progressives in my audience, because
wow,
you will find much to get your mind around in this book.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Enjoyable to speak with you.
You as well.
Thanks.
This was the second half of an interview with Dan Danello about his book, Technophobia. You can find out more about Dan at shockproductions.com. And you can listen to the first half of the interview at ieet.org. You can download the MP3 there and subscribe to the podcast feed from the IEET. Stay tuned for Bradley Lewis's talk about Prozac and cyborgs from the Neurotechnology and Cognitive Liberty Seminar the IEET and the International Humanist and Ethical Union organized at the United Nations on December 1st, 2006.
The title is Prozac and the Posthuman Politics of Cyborgs. Like James, I'm going to be using the metaphor of cyborgs or the trope of cyborgs, but it'll take a different spin, I think, than the way we've talked about it previously. It starts with a quote from Peter Kramer, who I'll tell you who Peter Kramer is in just a minute, that says, "I phoned my editor and left a message on her voicemail. I said, I know you're tired of hearing this sort of thing from authors, but something unusual is happening out here." The subtitle for the first heading, the first subheading, is called "The Epidemic of Prozac Signification." Peter Kramer's listening to Prozac first came out in 1993. As it happened, it made the bookstores about the same time as that year's American Psychiatric Convention. Kramer, a psychiatrist and new book author, was so excited about being in print that he ran to the bookstore near the convention center to see himself on the shelves. He found the book selling out as soon as the new shipment arrived. He says the staff had unpacked some copies that morning, but they were sold out. When I returned, the reshipments had come and gone. I never did manage to catch those books. As soon as they arrived, they were snatched up again. Listening to Prozac turned out to be a national bestseller. But at the time, Kramer was surprised and elated by the success of his book. He frantically called his editor to tell her something unusual is going on. With the advantage of hindsight, we now know that Kramer was right. Something unusual was going on with Prozac, but what exactly was that something unusual? At the time, the Prozac craze of the 90s was just getting started, and the fever pitch of the moment made it difficult to interpret Prozac. But now the hype has passed, Prozac is off patent, and the pressured commentary has dissipated. It's easier to get perspective on the something unusual of Prozac. Indeed, it's now possible to begin a serious cultural study of the technology. Clearly, part of the something unusual of Prozac was the incredible epidemic of Prozac prescribing. The Food and Drug Administration first gave Eli Lilly the marketing go-ahead in 1987. By 1993, new U.S. prescriptions had climbed to 7.6 million. By 2002, the year Prozac came off patent, that number reached 27 million. If you combine Prozac prescriptions with the multiple Me Too drugs it had inspired, the class of antidepressants known as the selective serotonin inhibitors, SSRIs, that total reaches 67 million new prescriptions in the U.S. alone. That means almost one in four people in the U.S. were started on Prozac-type SSRI between 1988 and 2002. No matter how you slice it, the major part of the Prozac story was that its status as a blockbuster drug, spawning an incredible epidemic of antidepressant prescriptions. But the number of prescriptions was only part of the something unusual of Prozac. Beyond the epidemic of prescriptions, another key part of the story was the simultaneous epidemic of signification that grew up around the medication. Representations of Prozac exploded during those years. In the medical and psychiatric literature alone, there were 4,654 Medline citations between 1987 and 2002. Prozac was also a frequent topic in the mass media and popular press. The drug was on the cover of Newsweek, Time, and The New Yorker, and it was often featured on the talk show circuit of Oprah, Geraldo, and Phil. In addition to Kramer's listening to Prozac, Prozac was the star of a host of popular texts, Talking Back to Prozac, Prozac Nation, Prozac Diary, Prozac Highway, and Beyond Prozac, just to name a few. Out of the cacophony of voices, commentators from many different backgrounds tried to sum up the something unusual of Prozac. With the kind of diversity, the interpretive diversity that inspired the basic cultural studies question is this: how can or should we interpret the Prozac story in light of this epidemic of signification? Is the Handbook of Psychiatric Drug Therapy right about the something unusual of Prozac? Was Prozac a straightforward example of medical progress? Or was psychology today more on target? Was Prozac a complex cultural phenomenon? Or perhaps Tribune Business News has the best interpretation. Perhaps Prozac is just good business. But then again, Andrew Wild seems to be onto something important as well. Perhaps Prozac is best seen as symptomatic of a medical system out of touch with healing and obsessed with technology and profits. How, in other words, should the Prozac story be narrated with such diversity of options? Was Prozac progress or regress? Panacea or Pandora? Should the clinical science literature have the final say on this question? The bioethics literature? If not, why not? What were the cultural issues of Prozac signification? What were the political ones? Who should answer these questions? For whom? With what claim to legitimacy? Next subtitle, The Time of Cyborgs. To approach these questions and get some additional perspectives on the Prozac phenomenon, let me start by backing up the Prozac story and putting it in the context of a range of new science and technology, or technoscience for short, that has dramatically infiltrated many of our daily lives. Just think about the amount of time you spend in some kind of synergistic interface with a machine. How much time in your day are you not on the telephone, at the computer, watching TV, listening to the radio, in a car, on a train, in a climate-controlled environment? How many thousands of advertisements have you seen in which happiness is promised through a technological interface? A long-distance phone call, an exciting new car, an opportunity to sit by the ocean, simultaneously connected to a global network on your personal laptop. These messages are always the same. Technology enhances life and brings smiles for a price. Increasingly, technoscience has infiltrated into medicine too. Although technology in medicine is not new, the recent explosion of technical capacities in medicine has created a qualitative shift in the practice of medicine. Indeed, we may increasingly understand medicine as a kind of applied technoscience. New biotechnologies, including advanced imaging techniques, genetic manipulations, organic transplantation, artificial limbs, expanded cosmetic surgeries, and an array of new psychopharmaceuticals have rapidly turned medicine into technomedicine. Not only has technoscience become a staple of medical diagnosis and treatment, technoscience has also catapulted medicine into an era of physical and mental enhancement. With further developments of the dawning biotech century, everything from human lifespan to mental and physical abilities to personality will be molded in ways that were previously unimaginable. In this environment, physicians and psychiatrists are in danger of becoming glorified distributors of the new technologies, sort of like car dealers with a medical certificate. The recent epidemics of Prozac prescribing and Prozac signification are located at the center of this explosion of technomedicine. Indeed, Prozac was one of the first of the new psychopharmaceuticals to sit uncomfortably between a treatment and an enhancement, between a medication and a mental cosmetics. In Kramer's words, Prozac ushered in a dawn of cosmetic psychopharmacology. But as helpful as it may be to locate Prozac within the new technomedicine, this contextualization does not solve our interpretive problems. Unfortunately, technomedicine is also not well understood. The technomedical invasion has happened so fast that the standard medical literature has not caught up with the full complexities of medicine as technoscience, nor has it even begun to develop a critical discourse of this phenomenon. Before further embracing the joys and smiles of a technoscience body enhancement, medical and psychiatric scholars must seek discursive enhancement to better understand and better cope with the rise of technomedicine. One discursive option I found extremely useful in sorting through the Prozac story is the work of cultural studies scholar of science, Donna Haraway. If asked, Haraway might categorize herself as a postmodern feminist science historian of the present. In her writings, she has initiated a great expansion of the cyborg metaphor, and she has been a major initiator of what many are calling cyberfeminism and some are calling posthumanism, although again with a different slant. Haraway, in the company of most postmodern philosophers and anti-foundational theorists, reverses, rejects, and ultimately displaces the notion that metaphorical meaning can be understood as distinct from literal meaning. For Haraway, the proper question for particular meaning formations, like bioscience, which are always already metaphorical and literal, are not simply the scientific and epistemological questions of whether the meanings mirror the world independent of human constructs. Rather, the proper questions are also the cultural and political questions of what kind of world this meaning-making will create. What effects will this meaning formation have on particular living narratives? And who or what is benefiting and why by making meaning in this way rather than another? Thus, when Haraway says, by the late 20th century, our time, a mythic time, we are all chimeras, theorized and fabricated hybrids of machine and organism, in short, we are all cyborgs. The cyborg is our ontology. It gives us our politics. She means to be both literal and metaphorical at the same time. Since the cyborg is always an inseparably organic and machinic, the cyborg displaces and renders non-essential, crusty Western binaries like the division between nature and culture, fact, value, pure, contaminated, organic, inorganic, and real, artificial. These distinctions, while useful in the past, do not work well in the current technoscience moment, which effectively blurs these distinctions. Haraway uses the cyborg to enter the fray of science politics not by arguing for a repudiation of science and technology, it's way too late for that, but by arguing for mixing up the scientific and technological with the cultural, the political, and the aesthetic. The issue for Haraway is not whether the organic and the machinic are mixed, but how are they mixed, and to what effect? Who is doing the mixing, and who is being affected? What are the social and political relations between the participants and the stakeholders? For Haraway, we may all be cyborgs, but not all cyborg mixings are the same. For Haraway, bioscience discourse is far from neutral and far from progressive in its political and cultural alliances in what she calls the New World Order Incorporated. Indeed, bioscience, while legitimating itself on a rhetoric of new scientific progress, is often simultaneously bedfellows with many of the old politically regressive power structures of patriarchy, racism, classism, ableism, neocolonialism, and homophobia. These alliances remain invisible, however, if bioscience is able to proceed free and aloof from other critical discourse, free from deep and serious cultural and political questioning, not only about the technical applications of bioscience, but also about what projects to take up, who should develop them, and what consequences will follow from handing over so much authority to the realm of scientific world-making, independent of democratic politics. The next subheading is called The Cultural Dynamics of Prozac. With Haraway's cultural studies of science in mind, let me return to the Prozac story. What is the relevance of the cyborg metaphor for the recent epidemic of Prozac prescribing and Prozac signification? How do we go from theoretical analysis to practical cultural analysis? How can we interpret the cultural meaning and legitimacy of Prozac and the psychopharmaceutically dominant psychiatry which Prozac metonymically represents? Who are the we who will do all of this? For starters, Haraway's cyborg theories help us sort out what will not work. From a cyborg perspective, neither standard discourses of science or bioethics can fully interpret the Prozac story. Like all technoscience, Prozac turns out to be too slippery, too contradictory, too coyote-wily for the broad-brush discourses of science and ethics to fully understand. Neither science nor ethics alone can come close to sorting through the Prozac phenomenon. The narratives of science and ethics are based on rather blunt distinctions: truth, myth, for science, good, bad, for ethics. Science asks, is Prozac science true or is it a myth? Ethics ask, is Prozac-induced happiness ethically good or is it bad? These binaries are too coarse. With so many significations available, science can provide no grand truth of Prozac. What we have instead are many situated truths about Prozac. Similarly, bioethics can provide no single judgment about the good or the bad with regard to Prozac. In some ethical discourse, Prozac is the dawn of light for millions of depressed sufferers. In others, it's one of the world's newest and most insidious of addictive evils. Cyborg theory helps us cut through these binaries. The undecidable situation of science and ethics does not mean that anything goes, and certainly not that all technology should be embraced or rejected. Both techno-bliss and technophobia are held in tension in a cyborg reading. The undecidability of standard narratives does mean that we must develop an alternative discourse beside the true and the false and the good and the bad to scaffold and navigate questions of legitimacy in a post-human world of cyborgs and cyborg technology. But what alternatives for legitimizing technoscience discourse arise? In short, without recourse to universal truth or universal good, questions of legitimacy come down to much more local political questions of consequences and inclusion. What have been and will be the particular consequences of Prozac? For whom? Who was included and empowered to create legitimate psychiatric knowledge regarding Prozac? Who was excluded and why? In the simplest form, what I'm seeking in this essay boils down to the priority of democracy over science in psychiatric knowledge production. Prozac, like other forms of technoscience, is not clearly oppressive or liberatory. It's a contradictory mixture of both, sometimes one more than the other, but always both. This makes the problem not Prozac itself, but the politics of representation surrounding the production and circulation of Prozac discourse. More people must be included in the decision-making process about the consequences of this kind of psychiatric research. And we must ask more forcefully who is getting to speak, who is being silenced, how can the knowledge production proceed from a more level playing field? How can more diverse groups get involved in the production and application of psychiatric knowledge? These questions take us beyond the usual forms of scientific and ethical analysis and regulation. If we wait till technoscience knowledge like Prozac is produced and then attempt to regulate its safe and ethical use, we wait too long. Just as we cannot delete an email after it's been sent, the challenge of technomedicine like Prozac is not only to ensure its safe and ethical use, but to create a more level playing field for its knowledge production. Thank you.
That was Professor Bradley Lewis of NYU's Gallatin School speaking on Prozac and cyborgs at the seminar on neurotechnology and cognitive liberty organized by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and the International Humanist and Ethical Union at the United Nations on December 1st, 2006. And you can listen to the other two talks that were presented there, one by me and one by Professor Elizabeth Phelps about the use of brain imaging to investigate topics like racism at the IET website. Just search on Phelps or Lewis or cognitive liberty, any of those topics, and you'll find those MP3s. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.